Rise to Rebellion, Disc 13.
Chapter 33. Warren. Charlestown Peninsula, June 17th, 1775. He had spent the morning in a meeting with the Committee of Safety, a scrambled affair, arguments about overlapping commands, the selection of officers who had no ability to lead troops. The meeting had been energized by word of the British response to the entrenchments on the peninsula. If anyone ever believed Gage's plan was supposed to be a secret, every one of Warren's observers in the city had sent him the same report. The barges would carry as many as 2,500 men, several cannon, would land them on the northeastern point of the peninsula. The objective did not have to be explained. By noon, nearly 1,600 colonial militia had spread out into a strong defense that extended from the north, a hard anchor behind a fence line that ran right to the water's edge at the Mystic River, all across the peninsula, to a position down behind Charlestown itself, men securing themselves in a narrow ditch dug out behind a short stone wall. Except for the town itself, the peninsula was primarily pasture. But there were no cattle. The farmers, Breed and Bunker, had removed their livestock to a safe haven behind the lines the rebels had constructed beyond Charlestown Neck. The cattle were too tempting a target for any British raiding party, and the assembled colonial troops required feeding as well. When John Hancock had left for Philadelphia, Warren had replaced him as president of the Provisional Assembly and had found himself embroiled in the chaos of organizing an army. The militia units brought plenty of enthusiasm to the lines that encased Boston, but rarely did anyone consider the value of discipline or drill. Sitting tight in one dangerous place had little appeal for many of the men whose expertise in waging war consisted of weekend marching in their own town squares, inspired less by patriotic zeal than by the admiring gaze of the town's feminine audience. Warren had been delighted to meet some of the officers from Connecticut and Rhode Island, some who could actually claim to be soldiers, veterans from the French and Indian War. Even if they had difficulty convincing their men of the value of military discipline, nearly a third of the men who lined up around Boston had once shouldered a musket in that very real war. The assembly had naturally assumed Warren would serve the fledgling army in a medical capacity, but his reputation for outright leadership had grown, and he had come to fill the essential vacancy left by the absence of both John Adams and Sam Adams, as well as Hancock, Cushing, and Robert Treat Paine. The assembly had been wise in their choice of delegates to the Congress, but with the delegates went the valuable experience the colony needed right at home. The motions for Warren to serve the army as chief medical officer were soon disregarded. Instead, he had been appointed as Major General of Militia, a title that technically elevated him to command just under Artemus Ward. Ward, another veteran of the French and Indian War, carried an old wound that plagued his health. Though Ward was sensitive to any suggestion that he was not fit for the command of an army of any real size, he received Warren's sudden appointment as a blessing. Warren had left the meeting by late morning, rode hard from Cambridge toward the sound that drew the attention of every man in the ragged army. From the first hour of sunlight, the thunder of British artillery had rolled over the hills. He reached Charlestown Neck, rode the horse past columns of men, all moving out along the narrow roads toward the peninsula. The rumble of the British guns had echoed both loud and soft, the sounds muffled by the roll of the land. As he moved close to the shoreline, the sounds suddenly changed, the air now punched sharply by a sound he had never heard, a rhythm of firing that seemed to come from everywhere at once. The horse was jerking beneath him, and he patted the animal's neck. "Yes, there now, easy. Let's take a look." He moved out into a clearing, the narrow strip of land between the Charles and Mystic Rivers. The sounds came again, startling him, the horse responding as well, rearing back. He could see the ship now, just offshore in the Charles, bathed in a fog of its own smoke. The horse settled, and he felt his heart beating, heard a man shouting to him, "You, get off of there! You're in the wide open!" He still stared at the great ship, the smoke now gone except for thin gray ribbons that drifted out of each gunport. The man shouted something again, and Warren said under his breath, "Yes, certainly, I suppose we're in the open." But still he stared, drawn by the enormous power. Suddenly the gun ports erupted. Perfect sequence, a sharp burst of flame from each gun, the ship hidden again by the smoke. He could hear the air splitting above him, a rush of sound, a sharp whine that suddenly stopped, the ground in front of the horse bursting in a great spray of dirt. The man shouted again, and Warren spurred the horse, could actually see the man now huddled down behind a fat tree. The horse was still nervous, jerking him sideways, and Warren gripped the reins, moved along the road, looked again for the ship, could only see the tall masts, the ship now masked by a rise of land. The man yelled at him again, "You some damned fool! They've been taking shots at anything that crosses the clearing. You was lucky. Just solid shot, mostly. Lucky for sure. If that had been a hot one, you and your horse would be blown to pieces." Warren saw the man had a musket, but was alone. "What are you doing here? Do you have a commander?"
"Oh, yes, I got me one gem of a commander. General Putnam's up better ways, left me back here as a guide. I'm supposed to make sure nobody gets lost. What you doing out here? You look like someone who's supposed to be somewhere else."
"No, I'm supposed to be up ahead. Can I find General Putnam?" The man pointed.
"Follow this road, take the left fork up there. That'll take you straight over Bunker Hill. Leave your horse up ahead a ways where you see the others."
He knew the route already, wanted to thank the man, but the sounds came again, the air alive with the strange whine. The horse jumped ahead, and he held the leather tightly, the horse moving him quickly toward the fork in the road. He knew the right fork went straight into Charlestown, but he had no reason to be there, and now he saw more smoke, different, black, tall columns coming from the town itself. He stared in shock. "My God, the town is on fire." He pulled the horse to the right. "I should be there. They will need help." But he hesitated, the road strangely empty, ghostly, no one leaving the town. No, they would have been the first to see the ships. From the first sound of the cannon fire, they knew what would happen. They're gone already. He stared, the columns of black smoke rising into one dense mass, then drifting away to the southeast, toward Boston. Now the thunder of the guns was far in front of him, another ship farther out in the harbor, beyond the town, and he could hear the impact of the shells, saw a sudden burst of flame, more black smoke, a new target struck. He tried to recall the town itself, the fine homes, the fishing boats, the people who wanted a life outside of the bustle and activity of Boston. But it was all wiped away now, the fires growing, spreading, and even if the people had stayed, they would only be able to watch their town collapse into black ash. He gripped the leather straps in his hands, tight fists, the shock turning to violent anger, and he saw another blast of fire, one more shell, flames engulfing a church steeple. He shouted out, "Why?" as his eyes filled with tears. "They have done nothing. There is no cause to do this." "So, General Gage, you will destroy the entire town. It will just cease to be." He thought of the man, the perfect uniform, the decorum, the politely veiled threats. "So now we see it. This is how you fight your wars." He pulled the horse back to the other road, looked up the long hill, began to ride, galloped over a short rise, then down again, reached the base of the big hill. He saw a line of horses tied up along a hitching post, saw one man tending the animals, spreading hay in a shallow feed trough. The man waved to him, said, "This would be the best place for your mount. General Putnam said no horses beyond here. There's lead flying thicker than bees up there." Warren dismounted, handed the reins to the man, gave the horse a soft pat on the neck. "She's yours, sir. I'll be back for her. Do you know where I might find General Putnam?" The man pointed up the big hill. "Somewhere's up there. Don't sound much like any place fit for man nor beast." He stared up the hill, could see streaks of red in the air, disappearing beyond the hill. The sounds had dissolved into his mind now, the shock gone, and he nodded silently to the man, began to move on foot up the road. Up ahead he could see the rear of a column of men, ran to catch up with them, saw it was no more than 30 men in a double line, a musket on every shoulder, each man clothed in blue, the pants and short jackets lined with a narrow red stripe. Uniforms, he realized, and glanced down at his own plain clothing. Yes, we should consider that. It gives them something cohesive, more than just an identity. They actually look like an army. He was breathing hard, slowed his steps, the column moving away from him. He began to look around, saw more men gathering in small groups, some lined up, others just a mass of disorganization. He pushed up on the hill, could see more men in line, more muskets, several hundred men, and he felt a hot rush of excitement. Yes, here we are, marvelous. He was on the crest of the hill, could suddenly see it all, the harbor massed with craft of every size, the great men of war spread along the shoreline, the massive clouds of white smoke drifting on the water. He saw other boats now, different flat red barges moving away from Boston, far out toward the end of the peninsula, but there were no guns, no smoke there, and he stopped. Suddenly, saw more of the strange boats now drifting away from the Boston wharf, moving out to the east as well. He could see more detail now. It was not the boats that were red. It was their cargo. They were filled with masses of British troops. Men were shouting all along the crest of the hill, and he moved forward again a slow run, saw one man pointing a sword, and he said, "Sir, I am looking for General Putnam." The man said nothing, pointed the sword down to the right. Warren moved that way, was running straight at the awful scene pouring up out of Charlestown, could see the flames now, the houses and shops engulfed in one black mass. "Dr. Warren!" He looked for the voice, saw the short, heavy man, and Putnam waved him close, shouted through the steady din of sounds, "At your service, Doctor, or should I say General? We're lining up here on Bunker Hill as a reserve. I am in command here, best as I can tell. I'm trying to hold these men together, not too easy. They've never seen anything like this. Hardest thing we have to worry about is keeping these men from turning tail and heading for home." Warren was absorbing the sights, motion everywhere. He saw two cannon now, pulled by a team of men, a small wagon behind, more men pulling a load of powder and shot. He could see the hill falling away on all sides, along the base of the rise only a narrow strip of land on either side before the rivers took over. This is an excellent place, he thought. The British would have to climb the hill, and unless they come in by water behind us, it would be nearly impossible for them to get past us. He stared ahead. The next hill, lower than where he stood, could see activity there as well, realized it was much more crowded, long lines of men, a fat square of fresh earth. Putnam was shouting, pointing to a column of men, "Get them up there! Move across!" Warren grabbed his shoulder. "Can you tell me, sir, why we are spread out on both hills? Should we not concentrate?" There was a sudden rush of sound, the sharp whine of a lead ball, and he ducked down, instinct. Putnam seemed impatient. "Doctor, I have all I can handle right here. This is the reserve. Colonel Prescott is up there on Mr. Breed's hill. That's the front line. I've been back and forth between these two hills so many times I'm lucky to be standing. I will try to send up reserves if he needs them. We're prepared to hold a good solid line back here, but that's where the British will attack. You can depend on it." Warren stared out east toward the lower hill, could see flashes of light all along the crest, scattered impact from the bombardment. Putnam was moving away from him, shouting something to the men with the cannon, and Warren said to no one, "Well, then I suppose I should go on to Mr. Breed's hill." He ran down the open face of Bunker Hill, the road dug out by the artillery shells, small holes now punched all across the flatter ground, some with wisps of smoke rising from the churned-up dirt. He could see a stone wall out to the right behind the hill, a barn to one side, men massing behind both in a thick line. Out to the left, the steepness of the hill flattened out into a gentle slope down to the shore of the Mystic River, and he saw a column of men moving that way, falling in behind a rail fence, some men hauling logs and rails from elsewhere to strengthen the fence itself. There were muskets in line all the way to the water, the shoreline itself a narrow beach just below a bluff of rocky earth. He looked up to the crest of Breed's Hill, then down to the left, studied the wide-open flat space, thought, "We cannot defend that. If they send enough men, they'll just push right through, surround Breed's Hill." He looked behind him. The long rise up to Bunker Hill. That's where we should be. That's where the defense should have been dug. He began to move again, hard breaths, his heart pounding, and as he climbed the rise, he could see the fresh earthworks, thick with men, more men spread out on both sides. He moved close to the raw dirt. A large square cut into the ground, nearly 50 yards wide, lined by a wall of dirt nearly 4 feet high. On the far side, facing east, an extra trench had been dug, the bottom scattered with ragged fence rails, one more obstacle for anyone trying a frontal assault. At last he saw the older man, William Prescott, tall and thin, climbing up on one of the earthen walls, staring out toward the east. Prescott turned, looked back to the men who still worked with the shovels, shouted out, "They are putting ashore! Prepare for the assault!" The shovels were cast aside, and Warren saw the men gathering around the stacked muskets. As each man took a musket, he moved to the dirt wall, lining up close to the man beside him. Warren stepped over the fresh dirt, closer to Prescott, who stared out through a long spyglass toward the end of the peninsula. "Colonel Prescott, I'm at your service, sir." Prescott looked at him, was suddenly wide-eyed. "Well, Dr. Warren." Prescott jumped down off the wall, saluted him. "Excuse me, sir, General Warren." Warren was suddenly embarrassed, said, "That is not necessary, Colonel." Prescott was not smiling. "General Warren, you are the senior officer here. I turn command over to you. You should know that the British are landing out there near Moulton's Point. They are already forming their lines along the shore. More barges are heading their way, some likely transporting field cannon. My best estimate is that they are landing near 2,000 men. We have here about 1,500 spread across this entire position. The reserve, I don't know the strength of the reserve." Warren stared at the man's hard face, another veteran of so many good fights. Prescott seemed to be waiting for Warren's response, and Warren thought, "He wants me to command him?" "Colonel, I was given the appointment of Major General 2 days ago. I cannot exercise authority here. This is your command."
"As you order, General."
"Colonel, I must ask, why are we not dug in back on Bunker Hill? Forgive me, but is that not a stronger defensive position?" Prescott stared at him.
"You are a better commander than you realize, General Warren. I argued that very point with Israel Putnam for better than an hour. As I understood General Ward's orders, we were to hold tight to Bunker Hill. It was a wise tactic. Even if the British came in behind us, from Charlestown Neck, they could never have driven us off that hill. General Putnam disagreed. His interpretation of our orders was to confront the enemy in the best possible position. General Putnam's concept of best is to be as far forward as possible. General Putnam insisted we be certain that Gage could see us up here. It's pretty clear by now that he can see us just fine. You might say, sir, that on Breed's Hill here we are sticking our chin out a little farther than I would prefer, but here we are, and we have to make do with what we have." He turned, looked out toward the east, and Warren could see a spreading red stain on the tip of the peninsula. Suddenly, he felt a shock beneath his feet, heard the sound of men screaming, and Prescott shouted, "Order in the ranks! It's just shot hitting the wall! They can't hurt us in here!" Others were shouting as well, junior officers pulling their men and themselves together, and Prescott said to him, "Been like this all morning. They complained like hell when we gave them shovels last night, but every time one of those balls hits that wall, they thank God for dirt. It still rattles them, though. Had a few come rolling right in here." He pointed, and Warren saw the round, shallow hole. "Still there, just plopped down like some big fat raindrop." The sounds of the shelling still cut the air, and Warren moved close to the wall that faced the harbor, could see the mass of black smoke from Charlestown now drifting eastward along the shore below. Men were still loading their muskets, some coming in over the wall, leaving the shovels behind. Now one man climbed up on the wall, held his musket high, shouted out, "Bring them on! Bring them lobster backs!" There was a low sound, one sharp crack, and Warren saw the man still standing with the musket straight up beside him, and the man's head was gone, the body now collapsing, rolling back into the earthwork into a heap, the musket falling to the ground. Around the man's body, some cried out. One man backed away from the awful sight. Others stared in shock.
Warren could not avert his eyes, the fresh earth beneath the man now dark with blood. All through the works there was a low moan, growing louder, each man feeling it in his own mind, the rise of panic. Prescott shouted now, "Dr. Warren, pull him back! Get him out of here! Get him buried, now!" Warren clenched his fists, pulled himself into control, leaned down, grabbed the man's coat, began moving him to the rear of the works, and now other men were helping, dragging the body out through the narrow opening. He looked around, saw the faces all along the fence line, some men doing nothing but watching the ghastly scene. He searched the edges of the works, saw a shovel. "Back this way! Come on, get the shovel!" One man went for the shovel, then more appeared, and quickly the hole was dug, the dirt flying fast. In short minutes, the man's body was gone, hidden beneath a mound of fresh earth. Warren moved back into the works, to the safety of the wall, felt his hands shaking, the emotion filling him. "No, stop it. You cannot lose control. There can be no fear." He could not help himself, stared down at the stain in the earth, all that was left of the man now, the man who would be a soldier, who would never have the chance to fight his enemy. All around him the men were crouched low, no one daring to peer out over the wall. Warren saw the man's musket still lying where it had fallen, and he picked it up, saw the pan covered, the powder still in place. "So you loaded your musket. Well then, soldier, I will make good use of it." Prescott was up on the wall, standing tall above them. Dangerous, Warren thought, stupidly dangerous. He wanted to say something, but Prescott shouted, "You can't see anything if you're hiding, and gentlemen, you should see this!" Gradually the men began to peer over the wall, and Warren realized the whining and thunderous sounds had stopped. He shouted to Prescott, "Colonel, it's quiet, the cannon have stopped." The silence was broken again, this time by shouts, a great wave of blessed relief, cheers. The men now stood, some calling out with new courage, cursing the enemy. Below, the black smoke from Charlestown spread a complete fog over the bay, blotting out all but the tallest masts of the ships, drifting in a dense fog into Boston itself. Suddenly, Warren understood. "It's the smoke! They cannot see us! The smoke is blowing right back over them!" He felt a burst of satisfaction from that. Damn them! May they choke on their own brutality! Prescott was still up on the wall, glassing out to the east. "It's not the smoke." "What do you mean?" Warren said, moving closer. "That's not why they stopped." He followed Prescott's gaze, stared down to the far point, saw that the red stain on the land's end was now different, pulled into two wide straight lines. They were much closer. One column coming forward down to the left, close to the shoreline of the Mystic, toward the fence line he had seen before. The other was moving straight toward them, beginning the long climb up the rise of Breed's Hill, straight toward the earthworks. He felt his heart jump, and he watched. They all watched. Prescott jumped down and pulled his pistol, shouted, "Let them come! No one fires until my order! Only on my order! Save your powder!" Warren rested the musket on the top of the dirt wall, sighted down the barrel, felt his hands shaking, blinked hard, tried to clear his mind. He watched them coming in silence, slow and precise, no wavering in their lines. Behind him there was an occasional shout, more men reaching the earthworks, and different sounds, a man suddenly overcome by the fear, running away, the others shouting after him, cursing, even laughter. Warren did not look around, stared only at the great, wide line of men coming up the hill. The line of soldiers was within 200 yards now, a solid mass of red and white, the motion of their legs visible as they marched in step, plodding up through the grassy hillside. Suddenly, far down to the left, there was one great blast of musket fire, the British reaching the fence line below the hill, the far left flank. He wanted to look, but there was nothing to see, his mind screaming, "No, look here, ahead!" And now Prescott was shouting again, "No firing, wait for my order!" There was another blast from the far left, muted shouts and screams of men, and Warren stared at the soldiers still coming, step by slow step, could suddenly hear their music, the fifes, the rhythm of the drums. Every part of him was shaking, sweat soaking his clothes, and he felt himself pressing against the dirt wall. Calm yourself. Concentrate. The drums were louder now, white legs moving with the rhythm, and he could see that they marched in three lines, each close behind the other, perfect order, pushed along by the drums. His mind was flooded now by the drumbeat, and he felt the rhythm in his own heart, could feel himself drawn forward, pulled closer to the soldiers stepping closer to him. Now he could see their faces, some of them glancing away toward the sounds that rolled up from the left. He could hear their officers, short, clipped commands, cool voices, holding the line tight, the steady advance, closer, the buttons on the jackets reflecting the sunlight, the glint of the bayonets. Prescott again.
Not yet. Don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes.
Warren gripped the musket hard, blinked through sweat again, his heart racing, his mind one hard scream. The entire hillside, the entire world, all of creation, every space in his brain now filled by the great mass of red and white. He tried to steady his hands, the drums still pulling him closer, and suddenly his mind fixed itself on one man, moving as they all moved, but this soldier's bayonet was pointing at him. He could see the man was young, pale white skin. Could see he was shorter than the fellow beside him, saw every detail of the man's uniform, the black boots, shiny at the top, covered with mud at his feet. Warren moved his right hand slightly, his thumb finding the hammer of the musket. And slowly he pulled it back, the hard click blending with the drumbeat, his eye sighting down the long barrel. He tried to hold the gun still, but it was shaking, jumping, bouncing about with the drums, the damned drums. And the end of the barrel was moving all over the man's body, his chest, his stomach. No, too low. Now the head, the young face, freckles. And he saw the man's eyes.
Fire!
The wall erupted into one blast of flame and smoke, and 30 yards away the British line collapsed into bloody screams. The smoke blew straight down the hill, hiding the soldiers who still stood, and all around him men were already reloading. The snap and click of muskets, other sounds, men's voices, some cursing, others crying, the emotion breaking free with the volley from the muskets. Warren was still aiming, still gripping the musket, staring hard into the smoke, tried to see the man, the boy, but the smoke was drifting away, clearing, revealing the extraordinary horror, a great mass of soldiers down in the grass, some moving slowly, twisting, some trying to crawl, and behind them what remained of the red and white line was backing away, some running down the hill, the order gone, the drums silent, erased by the sounds from dying men. The shock did not wear off. And the men stayed behind the wall, staring at the slow writhing of the men all across the ground in front of them. Warren felt a cold sickness, could see blood on the uniforms, the white shirts ripped apart, could hear moans, screams. Beside him, one man said, "My God, we killed them." Another man began to shout, shaky bravado, "Come on back, you cowards! Come get some more!" Prescott was moving quickly behind them, responded to the man,
"They'll be back soon enough. Check your ammunition, clear your muskets. No misfires. If you haven't reloaded, do it. This is not over."
Warren turned away from the awful sight in front of him, looked along the wall, saw the men at work, most loading their muskets, some sitting, their backs against the dirt, empty stares. He had a sudden burst of panic. "Reload? I don't have any musket balls. No powder." He saw the man beside him reaching into his pocket, retrieving a lead ball, dropping it into the barrel of his musket, then the quick jab with the ramrod. "Excuse me," Warren said, "I don't have any ammunition." The man next to him said nothing, no smile, no acknowledgement. He completed the loading of his musket, poured powder from a horn into the pan, snapped the pan shut. Then the man said, "Not much left." He reached out, handed Warren the powder horn, a round lead ball, watched as Warren poured powder into the barrel, said, Now too much. Don't want to break your shoulder. That's it." Warren felt embarrassed.
"Thank you, sir."
"Thank you, doctor," replied the man, still unsmiling. "If you hadn't come up here, half these men would have been gone already, maybe even me."
"I don't understand, sir."
"I'm not up here to die for some old goat like Artemus Ward. We volunteer to come here because we believe in what you've tried to do, the things you write about. But when a man stands up with a musket in his hand, sometimes it's hard to remember all that.
when I saw you, when you picked up that musket. Well, you honor us, sir. I'm privileged to be fighting beside you."
He didn't know what to say, the man now tending to his musket, and Warren said, "Where are you from, sir?"
"Connecticut. The coast, a little place you never heard of. I'm a weaver, nets mostly for fishing. Most of Colonel Prescott's men are from down that way. These others I don't know. Some are yours, some from New Hampshire, Rhode Island, I guess. Yesterday we heard that some Maryland men marched into Cambridge. New Yorkers, too. I suppose until the lobsterbacks decide to kick up a fuss somewhere else, these boys will come to where the fight is."
The man turned out to face the wall, and Warren looked down at the musket in his hands.
"Thank you, sir. God bless you."
The man stared out down the hill, said,
"Name's Johnson, sir. Rafe Johnson."
"Pleasure to meet you, Mr. Johnson." The words sounded silly, and Warren raised the musket, rested it on the dirt wall. What pleasure is in any of this? He could still see movement from some of the fallen British, many more very still. He closed his eyes, lowered his head, the word again rising in his mind, "General." Glorious titles. Glorious war. Prescott's voice broke into his thoughts.
"Up, gentlemen, no time to rest now."
Prescott was closer to him now, shouted,
"Where are the field guns?"
"Send a message to General Putnam. We need those cannon up here now."
Warren saw a man scrambling out through the rear of the earthwork, saw another man running in through the opening, out of breath, gasping to Prescott,
"Sir, Colonel Stark reports that the enemy has retreated on the left flank. We drove them back down the shoreline, sir."
"Return to Colonel Stark and tell him to prepare for another assault. They're already reforming. Tell him fine work."
The man was quickly gone, and Prescott was beside Warren now, said,
"Good man, John Stark, New Hampshire. A lot of good men here, Doctor. We'll need them all before this day is through. Too many green men, untested. We must hold tight here, keep these men from panicking. I will need your help, General."
"Yes, of course, Colonel. I wonder, should I be checking the wounded?" Prescott managed a short smile.
"We have no wounded, General. The Redcoats never got off a volley. That will change, though. Before this is over, we may have to deal with the bayonet."
Prescott moved away. And Warren watched him, thought, "I meant they're wounded." Prescott was talking to officers now, adjusting the men, shifting strength. Reports came in from all along the line, and Prescott responded to each one, no hesitation. Warren watched him, saw the others along the dirt wall doing the same, one word now in his mind, leadership. And he thought, "I came out here to tell him what to do. He should be the general. When this is over, I'll do what I can to see that he becomes one. This is the kind of man we need." Just then, men began to shout along the wall, and he turned, his heart suddenly jumping in his throat. He could see the British in line once more along the base of the hill, their perfect rows again. His mind was a jumble of thoughts. Already? So quickly? It's been barely 15 minutes. They began to advance again, and he studied the line, thick and wide, as though men had simply appeared from nowhere, no effect from the loss of all those who still lay in the grass so close to the wall. "So that's why we don't tend to their wounded. There isn't time." The muskets came up again, and Warren heard the hard clicks of the hammers, the men already prepared for the next volley. He sighted down the barrel again, heard Prescott call, "No firing! Wait for my order!" Warren felt the sweat in his eyes again, his heart beginning to beat in time with the drumbeat. He waited as they all waited, could see that the line was perhaps not as wide this time, that the angle was slightly different, more of the soldiers coming toward the earthwork itself. He tried to clear his mind, tried to think, knew that Prescott was in motion everywhere behind him. That's what a commander must do. "General Warren, how ridiculous. I'm barely fit to hold a musket." He could hear the drums clearly now, the rhythm rolling up the hill, could see the white legs in motion. He brushed at the sweat on his face with a quick wipe of his hand, then gripped the musket hard. He ignored the slight quiver in his hands, the hard knot in his gut, his mind becoming colder, focused on nothing but the march of the troops, the legs moving, boots stepping through grass, the drums filling his mind. The soldiers reached the bodies of their own men, stepped past, some looking down, a slow waver in the line. Warren began to feel an icy chill. Wanted to shout at Prescott, "Too close! They're already too close!" The calm in his mind was gone now, and he suddenly remembered the aim, found one man, then moved, another one, the man staring ahead with a look of raw terror. And Warren put the end of the barrel on the man's chest, the man still coming, "Too close! My God! Fire!" The muskets erupted again, and as soon as he had squeezed the trigger, Warren backed up a step, expected them to come right at him, straight over the wall. The man beside him suddenly grabbed his musket, poured powder in the barrel. Warren did not look at him, stared into the great cloud of smoke, all sound now. There were small flashes of musket fire in front of them, scattered response from the British soldiers, but the noise of the shooting was drowned out by awful screams. The musket was in his hands again, loaded, and Warren did not look down, leaned on the wall again as the smoke began to clear, waiting for a target, another uniform, another face. "Fire!" The gun kicked against his shoulder, and he was furious, had not aimed at anything, just pulled the trigger. He looked to the side, saw Johnson still aiming. Johnson fired his musket, backed away, reloaded quickly, handed Warren his musket. "Here, aim low." Warren turned, raised the musket, Johnson's words in his mind, "Aim low." He sighted down the barrel, scanned the ground in front of him, saw red motion, his finger on the trigger, but the man was on the ground, suddenly rolled over, blood on his chest. Warren raised his head, fought to see farther through the smoke, and now it began to disperse in the breeze. The soldiers were gone, and he thought, so fast? They must have run. Now he could see across the open ground a thick carpet of red and white, hands and arms and fallen muskets in one solid mass all down in front of the line. Men were down right in front of him, 10 yards away. And he could see the man he had shot, a new horror, not just a soldier, a uniform, but the man's face, wide-eyed, staring past him, past nothing at all. He turned away, saw that men were down in the earthwork, only a few from the British response, some of the soldiers returning fire. He leaned the musket against the dirt, moved quickly, bent low over one man, blood on the man's head, a sharp gash. The man grabbed Warren's arm. "They killed me!" Men were gathering, and Warren said, "A rag, a cloth! Tear his shirt!" Hands obliged, and Warren wrapped the dirty cloth around the man's head, took the man's hand, placed it on the makeshift bandage, telling him, "Hold it here, tight. You're not dying, just a bloody headache." He scurried away from a man, saw another, men gathering, and he shouldered between them, bent low, saw another bloody face, a neat hole in the man's forehead. He stood, looked at the others. "Pull him back. We'll bury him later." Prescott was talking to an officer now, and Warren moved that way, heard Prescott say, "Where are those damned cannon?" The other man was filthy, drenched with the sweat of a man who had done his work. "Sir, I heard General Putnam order Major Gridley to bring his guns forward. The next thing we knew, Major Gridley was hightailing it to the rear, guns and all. Didn't even say anything, just turned and ran away. Old Putt was pretty mad, sir." Prescott was furious. "Damned town square militia." He shook his head, looked at the man again, said, "What about ammunition? Is General Putnam planning on joining us up here? We need the reserves. We need powder and shot." "Sir, he's been ordering men to come up here, said to tell you he's pushing them as best he can." "Pushing them? Has he thought perhaps he should lead them?" Warren moved away from the two men, felt that small stir of panic again, moved toward his place at the wall. He looked for the musket, saw it was gone. Picked out Johnson now, holding one gun, the other on the ground behind him. Johnson saw him coming. "No more powder, sir. This one's ready, but that's all we got, sir." Johnson held the loaded musket out to him, and Warren shook his head slowly. "No, Mr. Johnson. You're the better shot, I'm certain. I'll make do. What about the others?" Prescott was suddenly beside him. "One shot per man, maybe. We can't hold up if they charge us. They're not going to just run away every time we give them a volley. They have bayonets, they'll use them." Prescott bent down now, picked up the empty musket, handed it to Warren. "I'd keep this if I were you, General. Make a good club." Warren took the musket, looked out across the sea of uniforms, muskets lying scattered. "Colonel, what about... we can take powder from the British?" Prescott glanced out over the wall. "You fancy the taste of a bayonet, General? A good many of those fallen men can still put up some kind of fight.
We go scavenging among them, we'll have a mess we don't want. No time, anyway. They're lining up again."
The men settled in against the wall, and Warren stayed back, turned the musket around in his hands, held the barrel, felt the heft of the stock. A club, indeed. He moved up behind Johnson, could see the wide rows coming again. The same scene repeated. Thought, how can they do that? They know it will happen again. We will slaughter them again. He looked around him, saw some men standing back as he was, clutching empty muskets, one man with only a small sword. The annoying panic began to fill his mind again. Yes, of course, that's why they do it. We cannot stand up to them after all. We have the men, we have the ground, we have the spirit for the fight, but we don't have the ammunition. He could hear the drums again. Had to see, moved close to the wall, saw Johnson cock the hammer on his musket, and Warren felt the sweaty grip on his own musket, said under his breath, "Aim low, Mr. Johnson." The British lines reached their own fallen men, the soldiers picking their way carefully, the march wavering again, but they did not stop, driven forward by the drums, by the hoarse shouts of officers. Now they were closer still, some now dropping down to one knee, breaking their formation. Some began firing their muskets into the earthworks, ignoring the shouts of their officers, the discipline erased by the sight of their enemy. The volley came from the wall again, ragged, uneven, no order needed from Prescott. The sounds in front of the wall were different this time, and Warren felt himself backing up, heard the voices rising, men in red suddenly emerging from out of the smoke, reaching the wall, bayonets first, some climbing up and over. The men along the wall began to swing their muskets, clubbing down the men in red, some grabbing for the bayonets, pulling the British soldiers into the works. He saw fists now, men punching and grappling, more bayonets, soldiers now climbing in from all sides of the earthwork. The muskets were silent at last, the only sounds the voices and struggles of men. Prescott's men were backing away, some staying close to each other, a solid wall of fight still, but now the British soldiers had targets, were firing, reloading their own muskets, more coming over the wall. Warren saw Prescott shouting his men back, waving a short sword, and Warren understood, "We cannot stay here, we must pull back, the other hill." Prescott was grabbing men now, turning them around, trying to keep them orderly, fighting the panic. Warren could still see some of his men lunging forward, defying the musket fire, the hand-to-hand fighting now all through the works. He tried to back toward the rear of the works, the opening that would give the men escape, Prescott shouting, "Fall back! Keep good order!" The British officers were shouting as well, holding their men back, breaking up the chaos, ordering their men to organize, muskets reloading again. British officers were up on the wall, directing their men out beyond the earthworks, fresh musket fire coming from along the fence line. Warren still gripped the musket, saw an officer coming over the wall closest to him, and Warren made a sound, animal-like. The raw fury of the fight raised the musket, made a wide swing, turned himself nearly full around, the British officer seeing him now trying to jump down. With a loud grunt, Warren swung the butt of the musket hard into the man's knees, sweeping him back off the wall. He looked for another target, his mind hot with rage, but the wall was now alive with men, a fresh line of red uniforms and bayonets, and Warren backed away farther. He could see Prescott's men filing quickly out of the rear of the earthworks, saw Prescott motioning them that way, unable to make himself heard. The musket fire was all around now, nearly all of it from the British, and Warren pushed his way to the opening, shouted at Prescott, "Go, I'll hold here, guide them out, you should lead them back to Bunker Hill." Prescott handed him the sword, shouted close to his face, "I will not leave you, sir. We must keep them in good order. I have sent word to the reserves on Bunker Hill. If they will come forward enough to hold the enemy back, it will cover our retreat. The enemy will not pursue. We must pull back in good order without panic." The words flew past him, and he dropped the musket, felt the sword in his hand, a new sensation, looked for a target, raised the sword. "Come closer, damn you." He saw men still grappling, one man on the ground, the British soldier above him, the bayonet coming down, saw now it was Johnson, the man's clothes bloodied, the bayonet pointed at his heart, and Warren screamed, began to rush forward, the sword raised, "I will kill you!" He felt a hard punch in his head, and the sounds were suddenly gone, dull thunder rolling through his brain. He found himself on his back, could feel the ground under him, tried to move his arms, lift himself up, lift the sword, but he was completely numb. Even his back, the ground beneath him, soft, no pain. He could see light, shadows, movement above him, felt someone pulling him along, his head raised, could see a mass of shadows now, all close to him, but no sound, no voices, hot wetness on his face. Now the light grew faint, darker, the shadows moving away, and he wanted to say something, but the thought slipped away, the images drifting, dissolving into quiet calm. And now his mind was silent. No shadows. No memories. On the hills above Braintree, the people had gathered, as they had gathered on hilltops for miles around, the roll of thunder from Boston bringing them out of their homes. They could see the smoke, the destruction of Charlestown, a quiet town so much like their own, engulfed and destroyed by this new and awful war. One woman had brought her eldest son, the boy now 7, held him close to her as they stood alongside their neighbors. Soon the black smoke gave way to a new sight, the peninsula just visible above Boston Harbor, alive with something none of them had ever seen. Patches of white fog from the silent bursts of musket fire. As she held her son close, the letter to her husband was already forming in her mind, and she knew she would tell him of this terrible day, the first time any of the people around her had ever actually seen a war. When the sounds and the smoke grew dim with the setting of the sun, the people left the hilltop, returned to their farms in grim silence, to await the first real news. She took her son by the hand, spoke gently in that soothing, sweet voice only a mother can summon, the voice that banishes the demons from nightmares. "Come, John Quincy, it is time to go home." She did not yet know the incredible cost, did not yet know that the British had left 1,000 men on that ground, did not yet know that the King's gallant marine, Major Pitcairn, had not survived the day, did not yet know that her good friend, Joseph Warren, had on this one day been a soldier. Part 3. The Flag Unfurled. Chapter 34. Washington. The Road to Cambridge, Massachusetts. July 2nd, 1775. For days after his appointment, he had continued to seek out the support, the kind handshakes from the members of the Congress. Despite all the celebrations in his honor, the lavish dinner parties around Philadelphia, he could not escape his own doubts, suffered through long, sleepless nights haunted by visions of failure. It was more than just his selfish pride, though he still felt that the job he had been given with so much backslapping optimism was far beyond his talents. Even his appointment to the Second Continental Congress had been accepted reluctantly, despite the convictions of Virginia's House of Burgesses that his good service in Williamsburg made his attendance in Philadelphia a foregone conclusion. He had assumed that his attendance at the Second Congress would not require as much time as he'd given the year before. As important as the duty was, and as clearly as he accepted his role as delegate, both journeys to Philadelphia had taken him away from a home life that had become more and more fulfilling to him. His 16-year marriage to Martha, his development of the land around Mount Vernon, and his dedication to farming were his true loves. Mount Vernon had become the one place where he could allow himself to feel pure joy with none of the chaos of politics. He had worn the old uniform because he had thought it was a necessary symbol, a sign that Virginia was prepared to meet any challenge. His friend, Richard Henry Lee, had understood this without Washington explaining it, knew that Washington was not a man to glorify himself, to elevate his reputation by the empty parade of a grand uniform. But Washington's service had been very real and, to Virginians, very accomplished. To his former superiors in the British Army, he had been an annoyance, a colonist who expected to be treated with the same respect as the British were, given the same opportunity for command and advancement in an army that made no secret of its prejudice against Americans. Both during and after the French and Indian War, his superiors had overlooked his leadership on the American frontier as trivial. And yet, to the settlers whose greatest concern was survival against the danger of the Indians, Washington had established himself as a dependable protector. The British required a certain number of colonials to serve in those positions the British officers themselves found repugnant. Washington had fulfilled that role, and when he expected some recognition for it, the reality had been demonstrated with brutal clarity. In the army, he was, and would always be, an outsider. The buff and blue uniform was of the Virginia militia, the source of the colonel's commission he still carried. He had been embarrassed at the reception he had received from the delegates, especially when word had begun to circulate that his quiet dignity and his experience of command had so caught the eye of the other delegates that he might be the very man to command the new colonial army. In the days after his official appointment, the Congress had named his subordinate commanders, and immediately there had been more conflict. Artemus Ward, who held senior command around Boston, was given the commission of Major General and would be Washington's second in command, a move thought certain to satisfy those in Massachusetts who would react with outrage because a Virginian was now in charge of their fight. Below Ward, another Major General's commission was given to Charles Lee, an expatriate Englishman regarded by some as the man who was more qualified to have Washington's job. Lee was now referred to as a Virginian, but considered himself a citizen of any place where he could slake a thirst for adventure. Besides service to the British in the French and Indian War, he had distinguished himself in mercenary service to the King of Poland, and was actually granted a commission as a major general in the Polish army. But Lee had sensed a new opportunity in the colonies and settled in Virginia, doing what he could to spread word of his own vast accomplishments. Besides his military skills, Lee became known as much for his unfortunate personal habits, an amazing disregard for personal hygiene, and his tendency to keep company more with dogs than with humans. Relishing the center stage, Lee was disappointed when Washington was named commander-in-chief. But his commission as third in command satisfied many who believed this loud, crude, and profane character was an essential addition to the army and might certainly become a colonial hero. Washington's uncertainties had prompted him to convince the Congress to name an old friend as his aide-de-camp, with the rank of brigadier general. Horatio Gates was another expatriate Englishman who had settled in Virginia close to Washington's home. The two men could not be more different. Gates, a short, round man with poor eyesight, who seemed, except to Washington, completely devoid of any likable qualities. Congress accepted Washington's plea, and Gates had joined the command as the familiar face and confidant Washington felt he needed. Bowing to the uncertain political climate in New York, the Congress appointed Philip Schuyler as a fourth senior commander to rank as Major General below Ward and Charles Lee. Schuyler was descended from one of New York's most aristocratic families, had given commendable service in the French and Indian War. The Congress and Washington understood that having a New Yorker on the command staff would go a long way toward bringing many in that colony closer to the patriot cause, who might otherwise choose to avoid any involvement altogether. The journey northward had begun on June 23rd, had taken 10 days, and Washington could not avoid the convoy erupting into a celebrated parade as they passed through both farm communities and larger towns. Word spread quickly, and the group was met by cheers and salutes from the citizens who knew from the first view of the line of carriages that these were the men who would command their army. When they reached New York, the scene had been much the same, but on a far grander scale. The outpouring had been more official, the New York Assembly voting a salute that would have infuriated their royal governor, William Tryon. But Tryon had been across the Atlantic, and though his return was expected at any time, the New Yorkers, who were notorious in their lukewarm support for the Continental Congress, took the most pragmatic route. They gave their enthusiastic support to the leader who happened to be there at the time. When the men resumed their journey, one man stayed behind. Washington made his first command decision, placed Philip Schuyler in command of what Washington himself labeled the Northern Department, with authority for any military operation that might involve activity toward the Canadian border. Washington had been in New England only once, nearly 20 years before, tried to recall the details of Boston, assumed that much had changed, even beyond the obvious that the town was now little more than a British camp. But as the convoy rolled closer through Connecticut, Rhode Island, the celebrations became more military, militia companies falling in behind, riding in support for a few miles beyond their town, some preparing to join the general's command at Boston. He had hesitated to write to Martha, had not felt anything like a burst of pride, the gushing need to tell his wife all about the grand appointment, the honor granted to him by that extraordinary gathering of men. But as the days passed, as the necessity of leaving Philadelphia on the long road to Boston had grown close, he realized that the clamor around Philadelphia would soon be clamor in Virginia. She might very well hear about his new responsibility from someone else. That was unacceptable. After staring at blank paper for several nights, the words finally came, apologetic, concerned for her feelings. He wished he could have seen her, truly revealed his thoughts, his apprehensions. He wanted to make her understand why it was so important, why he had accepted this amazing challenge, why he would not be home quickly after all. He could not bear to think of her in sorrow, mourning his absence. If only he could explain why this was necessary, she would accept it, as he was trying to accept it himself. But he would not see her, could not rely on some gift of eloquence he knew he did not have. Instead, he could only relate the extraordinary events in ordinary words, pass the news through the coldness of ink on paper. He had not made a copy, didn't have to. The first words still hard in his mind. "My dearest, I am now set down to write you on a subject which fills me with inexpressible concern, and this concern is greatly aggravated and increased when I reflect upon the uneasiness I know it will cause you." Would it, after all? She would miss him, certainly. But he was beginning to understand that she was home, surrounded with the familiar, the comfortable. It was her husband who was making this journey toward the thoroughly unknown. All along the journey he had passed the idle hours mostly in silence. The others most definitely did not, particularly Charles Lee, who filled every resting moment with ever louder and more spectacular tales of grisly and frightening adventure. And Schuyler, who before he gratefully departed in New York, had not hidden his distaste for the crudeness of everything Lee represented. Washington had tried to avoid both men, but he could not avoid what they represented. The contrast between these two might reflect the greatest problem he would confront, convincing very different people from very different worlds that they should fight and possibly die for each other, for one cause that was important to them all. Each day, as he rode closer to his new command, farther from the familiar, from all that he loved about home, his doubt still nagged him, more of the letter to Martha in his mind. "It has been determined in Congress that the whole army raised for the defense of the American cause shall be put under my care, as it has been a kind of destiny that has thrown me upon this service. I shall hope that my undertaking it is designed to answer some good purpose." As the carriages drew closer still to his new headquarters, he began to understand that the soothing words, the explanations, weren't just for her. Cambridge, Massachusetts, July 1775. A mass of shelters lined the streets of the town and beyond, the camp spread out over rolling hills, filling pastures and small clearings around patches of woods. The shelters were a blend of every kind of color and shape, tents of canvas, some made with sails taken from ships. Some of the men had built small fortresses of brick and mortar, complete with smokestacks. Others had constructed wooden shacks with a variety of skill, some merely huts made of straw and brush, with flat, peaked or sloping roofs of planking, cloth, straw, anything that would hold the weather away. The convoy rolled up into the square among the buildings of Harvard University. Washington held himself in the carriage for a long moment, waited for the others to emerge, enjoy the reception. He had hoped all along there would not be a great fuss, but he scolded himself. No, they should treat us as they see fit. We are visitors, after all. Let them pay their respects. Finally, he climbed out, stood on the low step, then jumped down to the ground. He looked for the official reception, the quick gathering, the great anticipation finally realized. But the men he saw were mostly tending to their own affairs, some working idly on their shelters, others sitting in small circles playing cards, a number sleeping on the grass, some minding small campfires and coffee pots. There were some glances toward the carriages, brief displays of idle curiosity. The other commanders had moved away from the carriages, had begun to question the scattering of guards or others who stood close to the larger buildings. An effort to find someone in authority, to find the proper place to make an introduction. Washington still did not move, tried to see something, anything that resembled an army, something to remind him that he was in command and not just one more visitor to an odd assembly of bored men.
"Sir!"
He looked to one side, saw Horatio Gates at the open doorway of a tall brick building.
"Sir, in here!"
He felt relief. "Well, all right, we shall do this inside." He began to move that way, long, loping strides, climbed up short steps, turned, looked out across what he could see of the town and of what was supposed to be his army. He felt angry at himself for having had some expectation of a grand reception. They know less about you than you know about them. That may be the first challenge, to convince them you truly are in command. He looked toward Gates again. Impatiently waiting for him, the small man scowling at him through thick glasses.
"I'm coming, Mr. Gates."
He strode into the building and saw Lee already talking to a small gathering of men, Lee's loud voice echoing in the large entranceway.
"Thousands of them, every town, every stop we made. Muskets held high, inspiration, that's what it was. A dirty job, for sure, but the men are there, willing to slit the throats, rip through the soft bellies of the Red Hordes."
Washington moved up behind Lee, scanned the faces of the man's somewhat rattled audience, said to Gates, "Is this the headquarters?" Now another man emerged slowly into the wide foyer, short, round, gray-haired. He stared at Washington with obvious annoyance.
"This is my headquarters, yes. Might I assume you to be General Washington?"
Washington made a quick bow. "Indeed, sir." He expected a formal greeting, some introduction. But the man turned, suddenly disappeared back through the doorway. Now the man's voice rolled out,
"In here!"
Washington glanced at Gates, who shrugged.
"I'm not sure, sir."
The other men simply moved away, disappeared down a long hallway, back to whatever duties were more of a priority than greeting some new foreign commanders. Lee did not hesitate, followed the man's words into the other room, and Washington felt strangely alone now. Said to Gates, "I suppose we should go in." Gates moved to the door, and suddenly Lee reappeared, a deep frown.
"He wants to see you, just you. Rude, bugger."
Washington winced, said under his breath, "Careful, Mr. Lee, let's not offend these people any more than we seem to have done already." Lee sulked away, and Washington passed through the doorway into an empty outer office, saw another doorway open, and he stepped toward it, stood at the entrance, saw the older man sitting behind a desk, scowling.
"Oh, do come in. Let's make this brief, shall we?"
Washington was feeling annoyed now.
"We have not yet been introduced, sir."
"Artemus Ward, General. There. That a sufficient introduction?"
Ward seemed to busy himself with papers on his desk, and Washington waited for more, felt suddenly like an intruder. Ward said nothing for a long moment, and Washington moved closer to the desk, glanced back behind him, saw the office still empty, no eavesdroppers.
"General Ward, would you prefer I make this official?"
"Save you the trouble, General. I hereby acknowledge your arrival and turn over command of this army to you. God help you, sir."
Washington removed a paper from his pocket. I have your commission, sir. Are you aware?
Yes, yes, Major General of your Continental Army. I am now subordinate to you. I am not sure what you expect here, General, but these men are not necessarily celebrating your arrival. We've done mighty well on our own, without anyone from Virginia or anywhere else telling us what to do.
Ward was still shuffling paper, and Washington felt his patience draining away, took a long breath. This is not a position I sought, but the Congress has appointed me. Ward looked up at him now.
Congress? And just who is the Congress, General? And what happens to your command when the Congress decides to go home? From what I hear, some of those people down there are still sending sweetheart letters to the King. They can't agree on anything. Any day now, one of them goes into some blue-faced fit about something, and the whole lot of them might just up and go home. For all we know, it might already have happened. And I'm supposed to believe that sending you up here is going to give us something to crow about? To start with, sir, why don't you tell me what you know about our fight on the Charlestown Peninsula?
I have received some details. If they are accurate, then you have every right to feel extremely proud. Your men performed with gallantry and inflicted extraordinary losses on the British.
Aren't you going to tell me how regrettable it is that we were so defeated?
Washington was beginning to comprehend. Of course. The retreat. General Ward, what your men accomplished is far more important than who now occupies that piece of land. If the numbers I received are accurate, your men inflicted something on the order of 40% casualties, with much lighter losses on your side. I hope you appreciate that what you did goes far beyond a tallying of acreage. You showed General Gage that a direct confrontation with our troops will cost him more than he can afford. They will be very hesitant about mounting another assault.
Ward stared at him, seemed to digest Washington's words, the scowl softening.
I hadn't thought of that, actually. You're right about the numbers. I assumed the word had gotten to Philadelphia that we were just pushed back. Gage accomplished his purpose, cleared us off the peninsula.
And where is General Gage now?
They're still holed up in Boston and the Charlestown Peninsula.
I wish you had a few more peninsulas around Boston, General. General Gage can have all the land he wants, if he's willing to pay that kind of price.
Ward stood now, the scowl returning, put his hands on his hips, paced slowly behind the desk.
It's a wise thing you can do, General, if you let these men know that news of what they did out there has spread beyond Massachusetts. Most of these men, even the ones from outside, don't really believe anyone from down south will support them. For all the ho-de-do about a Congress, when it comes down to it, it's the men out there holding the muskets who will decide this mess. You coming here doesn't really change anything.
I am aware of that, General Ward. You're telling me I have to prove I'm worthy of their respect.
Ward laughed. Respect comes later. First you have to convince them they should listen to a single word you have to say.
Your first job is to give them one good reason why they should even obey you.
This ends Disc 13.